Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, powered by Compass. I'm your host, Neil Lawson. These are unprecedented times and we need to rise to the enormous challenges we now face. From the economy, climate change, to the state of our democracy and politics worldwide. This is the space to jump into the deep end and embrace the complexity. This podcast lets us hear from and question the best writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists and activists to share their vision, ideas and campaigns to build a good society, one that is much more equal, sustainable and democratic. It's Bloody Complicated is supported by our Compass members. If you'd like to gain access to live discussions and raise direct questions to our guests, join us and support our work. You can register at compassonline.org.uk/podcast to become a Compass member and join the next podcast. But for now, just sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of It's Bloody Complicated.
Hi everybody, I'm Lena from the Compass office. Thanks so much for joining us this week. We've got Jerry and Esther Robertson to have a conversation. Jerry's the author of several books on Scottish and British politics. And Esther Robertson was the coordinator of the Scottish Constitutional Convention in the 1990s, as well as serving on lots of initiatives related to the Scottish Parliament.
Thanks, Lena, and hi, everyone. Hope everyone's well on what is a wet night south of the border, quite a long way south of the border. I'm really pleased that we're hosting this conversation tonight because Compass hasn't been that engaged in Scotland for quite a while, for good reasons. We were. When we first kicked off as an organisation in 2003, the independence debate wasn't anywhere near as much on the agenda as it has been since. And we work with Scottish colleagues on a whole range of issues, you know, pushing the then Labour government to do good things, helping them do even better things and mostly stopping them doing bad things. And those days are probably going to start coming back again, I somewhat think. In the meantime, there was this thing called the SNP and the Campaign for Scottish Independence. And Compass is a kind of UK-wide organisation. I mean, we don't really take positions on anything other than being really nice, believing in a good society and PR. We don't have positions. So we didn't have a position on independence. You know, we're Democrats, so we broadly believed in the self-determination of people under whatever rules, you know, and conditions we can, you know, we can have a conversation about that. And so, you know, when the campaign and the initiative really started taking off and the SNP won all of those, seats in, whenever they did win all of those seats in 11. And then the independence referendum took place in 2014. We didn't have a view. Like if Scotland wanted to beat Denmark on England and Wales's border, absolutely brilliant, show us the way. And if you want to work with us to create a better UK, absolutely brilliant. It's down to you guys to decide what you want to do. So we kind of withdrew from the Scottish scene, having kind of organised there, had meetings, a reasonable membership there, etc. We kind of withdrew because it wasn't a debate that we could do that much about or had that much locus or legitimacy to talk about. And the organisation's a really good one. Like Commonweal came into play that would, you know, ideas specifically for Scotland. So we withdrew. Now, the wheel has turned, you know, somewhat full circle. We're looking at very likely Labour government. What happens then in terms of the case for independence, how people who want a much more equal, democratic and green society can work together between Scotland, England and Wales, almost regardless of, and for some people, the independence issue is going to still be absolutely huge and quite rightly so. But how is that relationship going to work out between Scotland, England and Wales, between the democratic left, north and south of the border? How can we work together more effectively for all the things we want and contain and manage and negotiate our way round those who still want independence and those who are still opposed to it? And can we do that in a fraternal, respectful, positive kind of way? So that's why we're really pleased to have this debate. We've got two great people, as Lane has said. Some of us had a kind of private side conversation yesterday, a sort of small round table just kind of kick some of this around. And we want to do more stuff, you know, both in private and in public. about the relationship between Scotland, England, and Wales, and the issues, and the people, and the parties. And Compass can be quite a good safe space in all of that, I think, to host some of that conversation. But, you know, but let's see. But delighted to listen to this. I'll come in with a few comments and maybe a few questions or whatever. But back over to you, Lena.
Thanks. I'm going to pass straight to Jerry and Esther. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'll start, as we always do, with how are you and where are you? And Esther, if you go first.
I'm very well. I have to say I'm buzzing a bit because I spent yesterday afternoon in a constitutional policy lab about relationships between Scottish government and local government, and then joined the chat that Neil's just mentioned. So all of the issues that we might talk about tonight are red hot in my head. I've just realised it's unusual to hear it's wet down there because I'm in Fife, just north of Edinburgh, and it's actually dry. A bit dreich, as we would say, but dry.
Well, I'm speaking to you from Kirkcudbright, which is a town that the spelling of it isn't quite like how it's pronounced. So people who you can always identify visitors to Kirkcudbright because they're mangling it or BBC or UK media inquiries. And it's a wee town just west of Dumfries in Dumfries and Galway, the part of the borders of Scotland that's not called borders. And this is a super marginal Tory SNP seat. Currently, we have Alistair Jack, the sort of minister that every Tory prime minister kind of needs, who just does the job that, you know, question mark, you know. And so it's a fascinating terrain, often written off as conservative, but the conservatives are deeply unpopular here, in retreat. You know, the popularity of the SNP here is under question as well.
Great. Thanks, both. And we'll get right into it. What do you think the current state of Scottish politics is? How would you describe where it is? And where are the radical voices and the democratic left in Scotland? And I'll come to you first, Esther.
I was thinking about this afternoon, and I'm not sure I can talk for the democratic left, but I think politics in Scotland probably aren't all that different at the moment from politics across the whole of the country. I was saying last night, you know, I'm a very positive person, and I find it hard to be talking in negative terms, but actually people are frustrated, they're worried, they're angry, and at worst at times they're in despair. And I spent some of the weekend with our two sons who are in their 20s, and if you'd told me when they were born they'd be facing the kind of multiple crises, from climate to housing to economy to the gig economy to all of the things, one of them's working, nearly 30, working in the gig economy in film and television, one still at university, insecure housing, all of that, I wouldn't have believed you. But here we are, and I have to keep saying to them, we apologise. We had it really easy and really good, and we didn't know. And I think what summed it up for me in the last few days was that last week we saw, I can't now remember whose they were, I think there might have been multiple, statistics about poverty and inequality, and in the biggest cost of living crisis. And yet we have Westminster, a zombie parliament, I think is the right word. My understanding is working fewer hours than they've ever done, nothing being achieved. And those statistics were never discussed. I'm not sure they made the front pages of any of the papers. The story that most politicians at Westminster seem to be interested in was the flag on the back of a football shirt. And I thought that just kind of summed up why people are so disillusioned with politics. I think most people are keen to see a new government, but I think lots of people in Scotland are ambivalent about what a new Labour government might look like. And interestingly, given Jerry's point, I should say, Gordon Brown was my MP for all of my adult life, just about. And of course, we now have SNP here as well, in a heartland that you would never have imagined. I suspect that might shift come the election. We'll see. It's a good, solid Labour candidate, a good SNP candidate. Who knows? But yeah, so I personally am hopeful and optimistic, not particularly about the change at Westminster, but generally that things will get better. We're reaching a tipping point, but I am struggling with the level of despair and poverty that people are living with at the moment.
And Jerry, over to you.
I concur with everything Esther has said, and I have all my life been an optimist, and still am an optimist, and somebody once described me as a contrarian optimist, which I think is probably accurate, because I'm contrarian about most things. I think there's firstly that the sheer welter of multiple crises, you know, the economic, the social, the democratic, the geopolitical, the period of power politics we are living through internationally. We are living through a period of aggressive imperialism as well that we're all struggling with. And I find that the political articulation of people with voices in power and often those trying to challenge them, I just find bewildering and not something I find easy to identify with. Beyond supporting, like, obviously where my feelings go in terms of, like, the inequality of Britain, the child poverty that Esther mentioned, I think it was 28%, the UK figure, when Denmark's got a figure of 3%. And Israel, Gaza, and you know, recognising what happened on October 7th, but then, you know, what is obviously genocide. I just find I don't see politics there on a kind of like knee-jerk left, a self-congratulatory Scottish nationalism, or a very cautious Labour Party. And I don't know sometimes where that takes me, because there's always been an assumption since the Scottish Parliament was set up that it would do things differently and it would represent us in a more genuine way. I do feel, thank goodness we have a Scottish Parliament, because to have that democratic deficit that we had and that void and that lack of collective voice was wrong and became just something that was unsustainable. But I suppose I come from, this is where I get into contrariness in a way, I don't think the Scottish Parliament ever really began the process of democratising Scotland. We stuck these institutions, the Scottish Executive, it was called, was the Scottish Civil Service, and then we stuck the Parliament a bit onto it. Our government comes from those previously undemocratic institutions, and independence, the debate, gave us the opportunity, the tantalising chance to take that second stage of debate and, you know, democratise Scotland and hold people to account and do substantive stuff. And we didn't, after that flowering in 2014, it didn't lead to the substantiveness. And I think that's by design in a way. I mean, obviously there's other factors, Tory austerity and everything, but the SNP have become a party of the system, rather like the Labour Party, something I've written, you know, endlessly on. And I don't think that's good enough. And I know lots of people in the SNP who think that, but it's how you, from that point, that critique, how we get out of it, how we challenge it, that is one of the big questions. I'd like to hear some, you know, some thoughts and answers from folk on.
Yeah, and that question leads me nicely to the next question, which is precisely that. What do you think the structural conditions that create the obvious limits and failures of Scottish politicians and politics to deliver that more equal, resilient, democratic and prosperous society, where do they come from? How do they change? Can they change? And I'll come first to you, Gerry, just because you raised it.
Okay. Well, first quick point is, I think, right, at the moment in Scotland, there's a whole pile of who has and stooshies going on the internet and in, you know, what passes for public debate. One of them is about the hate crime bill, which I think is an outstandingly horrendous piece of legislation and sadly comes in a litany of terrible authoritarian legislation. Now, in that, there's the bash SNP perspective. I think we need to acknowledge that there's been a long tradition of Scottish authoritarianism and good society thinking it knows what good is. And the SNP are only the latest version of that. Labour did it before. You know, I was always saying to somebody today, when Labour talked in 1945 about the good society, in Scotland they called it planned freedom, because you'll have your freedom, but you'll do as you're told at the same time, you know. The very Scottish notion of freedom. I mean, I think it sort of worked for a period, you know, as well. But I think, so there's that point going on about understanding the traditions we sit in and that we're not as radical, obviously. I mean, everyone knows that. We're not as radical as we like to think of. But the second thing I wonder about is the stories of Scotland. And we've had a story that got us to the Parliament. There was then the missing stories under Labour. There was then a new SNP story that is now exhausted. And I want to hear new stories. I want to hear who's telling them. I want to hear who's not telling them. And I think in that, you know, just to bring it on to big substantive change, the stories of independence have been about a Braveheart version. Some people don't like that, even use that term, but a romantic version of Scotland. There's the Scotland why not version. We're a nation, why are we not independent? I saw an SNP minister saying that yesterday yet again. That doesn't take you anywhere. Greenland's a nation, you know, Catalonia is a nation. Nations are abstract creations. They don't need to be independent. The progressive Scotland story under the SNP is clearly exhausted. And it's, where do those new stories come from and voices? And I don't think they come from party politicians. I don't even think they come necessarily from politics. They come from the wider, you know, common wheel of our society. And in particular, the cultural imagination has driven a lot of these debates. And that's what I think we need to encourage, new voices and things that are not directly political to influence that political dimension.
Can I just, Leary, I'm only going to jump in one second and just get Jerry to think about this and then over to Esther. Why, because it's really important to us, this. Why hasn't or has PR made that much difference? So is there a difference between Holyrood and that system? And is there a difference between the council system? Because I don't want us to overplay how much PR could make a difference across the UK if the example of Scotland says, look, in on its own, it doesn't reset things anywhere near enough without those wider institutional, structural and cultural changes.
It's a great point, Neil. And just to be briefly, you know, because Esther will have interesting things to share this. It has reset things to an extent because if you go back, the 78, 79 proposals on devolution were for first past the post and a huge Labour majority. And of course, the SNP on 35% then in the 70s would have won a huge majority as well. It did change things in that there was the Labour Lib Dem coalition years. They weren't, you know, they didn't set the heather afire, but they produced. They produced a policy prospectus. They produced substantive legislation. Indeed, you can even argue that one of the things, this is for beyond this conversation, the Labour Lib Dem administration produced lots of legislation that it didn't tell a wider story of, whereas the SNP came to office and then told a story that maybe didn't have so much substance in it. But it did improve things. We had the minority years under Salmond where the Parliament became more the fulcrum of political debate. But it hasn't changed, you know, it hasn't changed political parties. It hasn't changed people like doing top-down things. And obviously, local government is like in England, but just probably a bit less so, starved of resources. And then because of that, starved of talent. And so it's better in the Scottish Parliament than if we'd had first past the post. But it's not, you know, you need a transformative culture. And that gets us also into like the nature of the public sphere, etc. Some of the things we've talked about before, like the nature of media, online things. But it's not always the fault of online warriors or social media. But it's the wider context we need to change. And we haven't done it enough.
Thanks for that, Jerry. Over to you, Esther.
Well, I wasn't going to start there, but given that Neil and Jerry have raised it, let's start with the electoral system, because I would share Jerry's view. I think it has made a huge difference. I think we have to acknowledge that for Labour, and I was a Labour Party member when I was doing the convention role. I survived for 5 or 6 years thereafter, and I'm no longer a party animal, but anyway, or at least not a political party animal. It was a huge concession the convention wrought from the Labour Party, because they knew that by signing up to a PR system, they were giving up their automatic right to rule Scotland. And we should never fail to give them credit for that. Now, we talked earlier about the political games. There was a bit of political gaming went on, because we were meant to have 145 MSPs, but that would have made it wholly proportionate. And the concession the Lib Dems had to make was to settle for 129, which meant it would never be wholly proportionate. The cynics would say it was designed to keep the SNP out of power. Come 2000, I mean, I often thought, and I said it to Donald Dewar, I wished that Labour had run the first government as a minority and not gone into coalition, but that would have been an interesting experiment. But the coalition government did a lot of good things, and I would give Jack McConnell credit it for getting us PR again for local government in the face of huge opposition from the Labour Party and councillors in particular, and did several good things. I think the Salmond government came into power, a minority government. I've just read today an article by James Mitchell, and I think he sums up one of my issues. He talks about how Salmond had a very small, tight group of able ministers and a real programme and ambition. And what I can tell you from having been around the Scottish civil service, they felt liberated by the drive and the energy and the ambition. And I think for the first 4 years that was right. I can tell you the morning after the 2011 election, my phone was red hot with friends saying to me, you told us this could never happen, that we would never have a majority government of any party. And of course, the people of Scotland had elected a majority SNP government. And under that system, it's not something you can game the way you can with first past the post. It told us something. And what it told me was that Labour had become complacent and had run out of steam. And of course, we no longer had the Labour government in Westminster. So I think first past the post has changed things. I think the reason we've got an SNP government that's now been there for 17 years, I mean, who would have believed any government would survive 17 years, is because Labour hasn't yet faced up to why it lost. And I think that's a big challenge and not one I can answer. The political scientists will give you that. But if we come back to where Jerry started about the democratic deficit, there are several things in there, and one of them is really topical at the moment. And I'm very much engaged in, and it was part of that discussion yesterday afternoon. If I was to say, like Jerry, what do I make of the Parliament? I'm delighted we've got it. I'm thrilled that the people the age of my sons don't know anything different. They would never question us not having it. And I do believe it's done a lot that's good. But it has also let us down on a range of fronts. And at the 20th anniversary, 5 years ago, the Consultative Steering Group was reconvened. We wrote the report that produced the standing orders. And we had, it's a public document, we had Jim Wallace, Henry McLeish and George Reid, who'd served in the Parliament as ministers, presiding officers, first ministers. And we were unanimous about what had disappointed us. And the first one was the new politics we all hoped for that we'd seen all the way through the convention disappeared. And I think we've descended over the 25 years to a level of toxicity in the Parliament that's shocking. But actually, it's not just a Scottish phenomenon. It's common. It's the Westminster. Yabu sucks politics. The second was it hadn't been bold enough. And everybody agreed with that. And Henry, as First Minister, talked about things he wished he'd done. And he, you know, he brought in free personal care and various other things in his short tenure. But the third one, which is the one that's most topical and I think relates to the wider democratic question, we addressed the democratic deficit between Westminster and Scotland. The Parliament was supposed to commit to that devolution then spreading out across the country. And my, I don't know if I said this in our private conversation, my biggest regret is that I spent 2 years touring the country, explaining the Parliament, how it would work, how you would elect it. And the most common question was, will it not just suck up power from local government? And my answer was, no, no, no. They have committed to subsidiarity, to devolving power, da 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 da. I was so naive and so wrong. And we could have a whole podcast about why that is. But the bottom line is, again, not a party political point. Subsequent governments across 25 years have continued to suck power up. We keep talking about Denmark. If you look at Denmark or Norway, and I was saying this in the 90s, they have 10 times the number of councillors that we have. We have 1,200. Norway has 12,000. You say that to people in Scotland and they throw their hands up in horror at the notion of all these extra councillors. But the answer is, in those countries, they're not full-time jobs. People do their council role alongside other things. And politicians at local level are known in their communities. STV in our parliament has, in our local government, has not delivered that. And we have some of the largest councils in Europe. Highland Region, Highland Council, has the geography of Belgium. And it takes hours to get from somewhere like Westeros or Fort William to Inverness. So there's that kind of logistical stuff, but it has made it feel remote. And if you're in Shetland or in Orkney or down in Kirkcudbright, you will feel just as remote from Holyrood as you did from London. And I think that's been the single biggest failure across the 25 years, which a number of us are now trying to push. I'll finish with the positive thing, though, because I am like Jerry. I think I'm an optimist. I once said I was an idealist tinged with pragmatism. And a former colleague that you would know said, you can't. You're either one or you're the other. There are lots of good things happening in Scotland, but they're happening in England too, that are bottom up, that are taking control. Councils like East Ayrshire have started the Vibrant Communities programme, putting power into the hands of communities to determine not 1% of the budget for participatory budgeting, but real power to say, this is what we want for our village, our town, our community. Somebody said yesterday, don't start with structures, but don't let structures get in the way. I think we've reached a point where we'll have to address the structures, but it doesn't mean we can't be democratising. And I'll finish with a point which is not meant to be about politics and democracy, but it transfers. There's an Irish writer called Cormac Russell who writes about asset-based community development, and he talks about a gradual shift. And he talks about how originally we had a very patriarchal, things were done to us. And then we moved to them being done for us. And now we're somewhere around the being done with us. But actually what we want is being done by us. And it was the Manchester leader, I think, a young woman leader of one of your councils in England, did a podcast and she said, the best thing a leader can do is give their power away. I don't like the empowerment one, but let's give power away, because like love, actually, you don't lose anything when you give it away. You might think you do. And I think that ABCD, asset-based community development, but I think that four, two, whatever way around it is, with and by, is the journey we're on. And I think lots of communities are getting to the by space. Yeah. And good councils are beginning to realise they can do that, even within the ridiculously difficult. And if you hear somebody like Donna Hall from Wigan or Katie Kelly from East Ayrshire, they'll tell you, you don't need more money to do that. And actually, if you do it right, it saves you money.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had a webinar last week with some of the people running the campaigns and the participatory community engagement and running the councils that do these projects. And they are coming up, but they are incredibly underfunded and they need more time with people and all that. So,
Could I make one other point about the democratic deficit? The Parliament has not addressed the thing that I feel most strongly about. And folks find it odd because if you check my media coverage over 20 years, you'll hear me described in derogatory terms as a quango queen. We had all these quangos set up to address the democratic deficit. The idea was once we got a Parliament, we'd start to pull back from that. And those powers would be either in the Parliament or in local government. The quango state has exploded. And we haven't addressed that either.
Right. Jerry, did you want to come in on that?
I think I'm going to come in on one thing, just because that was very, there's a lot in there and a lot to unpack. But I just want to, and I don't mean challenge, but I just want to, there's a version of Scotland that has just basically thinks Scotland is Labour. And basically everything that's happened is because Labour were, once right and then got it wrong. And Esther, you probably, just by misspeaking, you kind of alluded or strengthened it. When the SNP won in 2007 and 2011, they won the big victory. It wasn't just because of Labour weakness. Obviously, it was Labour weakness, but that's what you said. And there was also the story of the SNP positioned themselves. 2007, they embraced a thing called positive psychology, so they changed messaging. 2011, they presented this three-point vision of Scotland's future that was about reindustrialisation, and two other ones I've forgotten. And similarly, the fact that SNP have remained in office 17 years has been aided by Labour weakness. But it's not just about Labour weakness. It's the fact that SNP have become what Labour were, both positive, centre-left, et cetera, being a bit, lefty on some things, redistributions, but not that cautious as well. That combination that a large part of Scotland likes, and then they've also ended up becoming like Labour, becoming a system party, and it will slowly devour them. So it's not just about Labour, and I know you didn't mean it, Esther, but it's a common assumption that lots of people made, particularly the Labour quangocracy and extended state. I used to sit in conversations up to 2011 where various people who I respected would say, it's going to start again, isn't it? Labour's coming back. Because it wasn't like just their self-interest, it was just their total... Probably was a bit, but their total frame of reference was around the Labour story of Scotland. And like the SNP, it was never the whole story. It was never the majority. First past the post made Labour think the majority. The SNP's victory in 2011 and being nationalists, maybe nice nationalists, but still nationalists, makes it a totalising project, which inherently eventually has major problems in it. That's maybe something we can touch on later, because nationalism on its own is never, ever enough anywhere in the world. And Scotland is not going to be the exception.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I did not intend to suggest you're quite right that it was because Labour failed, SNP won. They won because they fought a very good campaign. I think Labour had run out of steam. I think the point I was trying to make was we never wanted there to be official opposition parties. That wasn't going to be the new style. But sadly, we did get them. But of course, Labour lost so badly, they weren't the opposition. I think the point I would also make, people are often surprised, as I was when I learned in the 90s, the only party that's ever won a majority in Scotland were the Tories in 1955 or something. When I was doing the presentation about the electoral system for the Parliament, Andy Miles, then of the Lib Dems, had done a whole project for me, tracking as broadly as you could putting the new voting system on the voting patterns of the last 40 odd years. And I put up this pie chart of half a dozen. And the thing that people always gasped about was, without question, 25% of that pie chart was blue. And it's one of the things I find difficult about the current political debate in Scotland. 25% of Scots are right of centre, natural Tory voters, maybe not for this particular Tory government, but yeah, they are Tory voters. And if we're Democrats, they've got a place in all of this.
I remember, Esther, when we had the peak SNP of after 2014 in 2015 that Neil alluded to, when they won 56 of the 59 seats and then went on the, well, not the SNP officially, but party members went on the project of hunting Alistair Carmichael as the last surviving Lib Dem through some case I can't even remember. But I remember feeling relief that in that election, the SNP only won 49.97% of the vote. They just shaved under 50%. Because I thought then, they're already becoming insufferable, the tradition, the tribe, and they're, you know, they're immune to the fact of, like, they don't want to be called one-party Scotland in the way they used to bash Labour's one-party Scotland. Neither were, obviously, it was a phrase, because it wasn't a one-party state, but it had connotations of it. And we've lived with the effect of that hubris. And then that coming down from that, and then that dulling of that political antenna, I sense, combined with a point somebody made yesterday, that we're still coming to terms with what happened in the Sturgeon years, when a political leader with piles of capital, with huge appeal, with communication skills, with the human touch, didn't reset government enough. I mean, there's obviously achievements in that period, but didn't reset government, didn't make what she said were her priorities the priorities of government. And obviously, I mean, I do think this is fundamental, but the sheer lack of honesty on independence. And I have good friends who, they're not idiots, they're not people who are dupes, etc., but they wanted to believe Sturgeon till nearly the end. And then they realised when she resigned that they'd been told a pack of, you know, make-believe, basically, you know, magic kind of a way, fables, and a politics of dishonesty is just, and telling people what they want so that, or what people want to hear and interpret as, is not leadership. Yeah. And that's something we're coming to, you know, terms with what the consequences of that are still, I think.
She's not alone.
Before we go to questions, I do want to ask one more question from us about the path forward. So we've talked a lot about the deep similarities between Labour and SNP, and you've touched on that in your recent piece for Compass. Can you see a path out of this kind of stagnant, stale and quite alienating, disenfranchising politics that both the leadership of the SNP and Labour seem to perpetuate? Can you see a path out?
Is that, which one of that is?
Esther, jump in.
Okay, I think, and I think I've said this in a couple of contexts recently, I sat on the Press Complaints Commission for 7 years in the Leveson years, which was in the run-up to the independence referendum. And when I went down to London, I was always asked about it and what was happening and all of that. And the usual question was, why do Labour and the SNP hate each other so much? And again, that's another discussion that could form a whole podcast. I actually think that's changing. And I think the younger generation of politicians are not of that ilk. They don't remember the things that happened, that some of them weren't born, that created that kind of culture. So I think that's going to change things as that younger generation of politicians comes through. I think also, though, especially if there is a Labour government, there's going to be a whole different thing. You know, the Parliament got an easy berth because it had a Labour government, a Labour Lib Dem coalition government here, a Labour government in London, and at a time when public spending was plentiful. We didn't have to do anything hard. I can remember coming down the motorway one day and hearing Gordon announcing 1% on national insurance for the health service. And I was chair of a health board at that point, and I was screaming at the radio saying, don't do it. They don't need to get more money. We need to fix it and put the money over there, you know, to improve health rather than health service. That would be considered heresy. But anyway, money was relatively plentiful. I think the other thing that will change, though, is that the young people who, whether they want independence or not, are not apathetic. They're fed up with politicians, but they are engaged. The day of that breakup of Britain conference, we had 700 people on a wet Saturday give up a whole day for an event. And the comment was, where are all the young people? And the answer is they were on the streets of Glasgow protesting about Gaza in the rain. You know, they are there. And I think they are going to start demanding a different approach. And I think we will begin to see a change and a bit more boldness. And I think even those people, you know, we're at 50% in favour of independence. People assume 50% are against. That's not what the numbers say. There's a chunk of that 50% against, and there's a chunk that aren't sure. And there are a chunk of people in the 50% that are in favour who would settle for something different. And I used to say in the convention, I didn't believe we needed independence. I didn't want independence, but that I'm a Democrat. Like Neil said, if the people of Scotland want it, we're perfectly capable. What I want, and I won't use the United Kingdom because I find that language difficult, and it's interesting you never mentioned Northern Ireland, Neil. I would love to see a renegotiated relationship where the four nations, and of course it might end up being a United Ireland, not a Northern Ireland, renegotiate how we work together and that we do actually have full autonomy and we agree how we share. And I think when I heard Gordon Brown was commissioned to do the review for Keir Starmer, I was really hopeful. Not only does the report not go far enough, it looks to me like Keir Starmer's drawing back. Once he gets into power, if we assume he does, that would be the biggest thing he could do, is start to show respect for the four nations, England included, and bring about a new constitutional settlement that could avoid the breakup of Britain if we could agree a grown-up way to move forward. I think it's Kieran Martin, the professor, who was a civil servant that negotiated the Edinburgh Agreement for the 2014 referendum. I've heard him speak about a lot this journey, and he says, the difficulty we've got after the Supreme Court judgment is we do not have a voluntary union. And as long as the union is not voluntary, it is going to run its course and people will go it their own way. And if you told me the week of the referendum in 97, we had a huge vote in Scotland for the parliament. Wales got 50.1%. They scraped through getting the Senate. They've now got 30% of the population wanting to be independent. It's not just about Scotland. We've got the Scottish question, the Welsh question, and the Irish, Northern Irish question, and Westminster need to wake up to it. And there is an opportunity to do something really positive. Thanks, and I'll stay hopeful. I'll stay hopeful.
How pragmatic. Jerry.
Sorry, what was the question again?
Do you see a path out of this? What is something better look like and how do we get there?
Well, I mean, you know, the dynamic of Scottish politics, Scottish society is constantly churning and changing. We're still living in the aftermath to an extent of the big bang of the independence referendum in 2014. Mm-hmm. The aftermath maybe didn't change the public sphere and public life as much as people like myself wanted, but the mainstreaming of independence, the fact it came in from the cold, the fact it is, you know, one of, if not the defining issues of Scottish society and politics, is a game changer. Because if you go back, you know, into my childhood and so on, it's true that independence wasn't anywhere in the mainstream. It was regarded as something that was the long, you know, long lifers of the SNP, a small gang who had kept it alive. So that's a change. I think also, in terms of younger people, the issue of, when I was talking about stories, there's generational stories here. Mm-hmm. We can't continually talk about being a progressive Scotland if we don't do stuff and if we don't take on power, if we don't redistribute, which involves challenging interests. It's not easy, and things like that. And we need to change from constantly invoking our own past battles. We can't continually go on about, you know, Thatcherism is still this iconic evil in Scotland. And of course, making the point I'm making is not, it's not an advocacy of Thatcherism. It's merely to say that something I've written about at length is how conservative the small C Scotland disguises itself and presents its radical credentials is things like constantly invoking, you know, the evils of Thatcherism, which I think there was some institution last week, oh, the Rachel Reeves speech, that a pile of Scotland were out going on about 1979, and then that relates to a point Esther was going on about yesterday, 1979, when the evil SNP brought down the Callaghan government, which isn't even true. It was the SNP and the Lib Dems and Liberals, etc., etc., and obviously the Ulster Unionists. And then you've got Tony Blair and the Iraq War. Now, just to bring it up to the present, in the independence referendum, there was at least two visions of Scotland implicitly on offer. One was the SNP one saying, trust us with our bright new shiny state we're going to have, and modernity and progressive Scotland will all be fine the other side, despite the fact they're in a, you know, shit condition all over the world. Our one will be fine. We'll bust bust international global system. That was the radical version. But the SNP version said the former part. And then there was another version, which I associate quite a bit with younger people, but it wasn't just younger people. It was radicals and people that had stopped trying to change the state. And it was the self-organising, self-governing Scotland. It's the one that I saw a huge strength and nurture in the lockdown, the COVID lockdown. And it was really, really a wonderful flowering in the Indy Rev. But obviously, the SNP ran with those two tram lines, not saying there were two tram lines, because they had their planned freedom version of Scotland, the current version. And I don't think there's any mileage in that SNP version of independence. I'm really not attracted to it at all. But I think that second version of Scotland, which is an example of flowering you see all around the world, when you say, we don't trust the state, it wasn't there for us when we needed it, you know, the social contract's been ripped apart, we don't trust corporate takeovers of politics, etc. You know, a compass agenda in all. And I just think two sort of final points on this is, honesty is kind of fundamental to the politics of Scotland growing up, and of course then of independence. And in that is economic literacy. So one of the stooshies we've had in the last few weeks has been, the last few week, has been the American-based academic who's from Dundee, has made a series of comments about independence that he says were taken out of context, but the main comments are completely right. You know, modern monetary theory doesn't work. It's a fantasy Keynesianism. He also said things like, you know, the nature of the Scottish economy, which has been produced by, you know, centuries of capitalism and the union, is not an economy that is fit at the moment for independence. That's self-evident. And he also said things like, we can't be fully Nordic. That was a point I said quietly to lots of people in the Indie Rev when Leslie Rurick, wonderful as she is, was presenting, you know, Nordic horizons, we can be like Denmark. No, we can't be like Denmark. We can be who we are, a better version of ourselves, as the cliche goes. We can do things inspired by people like Denmark and Nordicness, and we can have Nordic alliances, but we will always be part influenced by the traditions we come from as well. We can make them, you know, better. We can, you know, take away the worst aspects of Anglo-American capitalism. Maybe one day we can abolish it. But we can't live in fantasies, and we can't live in dishonesties. And this is my last final point, is in that it was a point that Fintan O'Toole, the Irish writer, made in the Indie Rev, in an introduction to a book of mine, Caledonian Dreaming. And he said, independence is about, it's a great phrase, it sums so much up, independence is about the art of growing up. And I thought, I wrote it, I thought, oh, that's lovely, that's it. But then I understood after the Indie Rev, growing up is difficult. Growing up has growing pains, and part of Scotland doesn't want to grow up, and part of independence on the independence side don't want to grow up either, because they're hunting their victims and their villains. They're shouting down, you know, people like Mark Blythe telling them uncomfortable truths. And if we are going to get out of the current, you know, our broken state of politics, which of course isn't as broken as Westminster, but it's clearly dysfunctional, we have to nurture places where we can calmly tell each other honest truths and work out, you know, collective truths, because at this moment we don't kind of have that basics. We have people going on about, you know, what happened with the Macron report in 1975. It wasn't a conspiracy, it was a civil service document, or a chap, you know, I've even forgotten his name for a second, the chap who constantly goes on about the JERS, who isn't actually an economist, but he's an accountant, but he presents himself as a professional economist. And that might not matter if there wasn't a ready constituency wanting to believe that JERS, the figures the Scottish government makes up about territorial public spending, were somehow some plot to undermine Scotland. And so I guess in all that is, how do we tell truths? How do we have leadership that, you know, political leadership, because I think a lot of the Sturgeon era was a vacuum despite the omnipresence. And how do we take that leadership ourselves and grow up? Because I think it's difficult for lots of people in lots of ways, I understand.
Yeah, but it's also time.
Absolutely.
I'm going to pass to Harry, who's got our members' questions ready.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
So I'm just going to bring around two because they're two slightly related questions. And then I'll hand over to you guys. So bringing in Roland first.
Hello, Jerry. We know each other already. Esther, obviously fascinated to hear your historical perspective, really valuable. And I find myself at this moment more in sync slightly with yourself, funnily enough, than you, Jerry, which may surprise everybody here. But it's all because of what happened at the SNP National Council 10 days ago. This has not been reported in the press. It's gone almost unnoticed, but it's so significant. The Environment and Climate Officers of Climate Environment Group in the party decided to call for a remit back on a motion on investing, and that's a key word here too, in a just transition. Mm-hmm. Now, there was an exciting debate. We won the remit back. Very narrow margin, 4 votes, but it had an effect. 2 motions further on was one that related to democratising Holyrood. On that motion, the point that carried the day was what the potential is of citizens' assemblies. And the vote this time for a remit back was almost unanimous. I have had a lot of feedback from people since then saying something has suddenly changed, where people within the party now feel emboldened. This came through at the Scotonomics events, the Festival of Economics in Dundee over last weekend. And we could get into a long debate around modern monetary theory and so forth. It was explained rather differently, Jerry, but we'll do that after this occasion. But one thing came through that I think is incredibly exciting. We've kept on using in the SNP the mantra of Europe, 62...
We need a question, Roland, because there's other people want to get in.
Sorry, very quick. The absolute last point is that we raise the point as climate activists that actually, with just transition, Scotland should be looking first and foremost to the global south for our alliances, our economic relations, and everything else post-independence. And I'm curious to hear what your views are on any aspect of these. I think that's the reality. This is where thought is trending in Scotland, at the events at least where I've just been at.
Can I come in here?
We're going to get 2 questions and you can come back.
Just the second one is related to this. It may have been covered slightly by that, but just to give another person a chance to speak, we're going to bring in Joanna. Hi, Joanna.
Hi there. Yeah, I think I'm building on Roland's question, but I rather got lost by the time he finished talking. But my question was really partly to do with independence and just partly to do with kind of what kind of power the Scottish people might have. But he said he was talking about the kind of choices could be around the Scottish people being in a position to take control of their natural resources. And my concern would be that given an awful lot of those natural resources are fossil fuels, how is Scotland going to be able to play its part in reaching zero carbon, whether it's independent or not?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Joanna.
Right, thanks very much. Shall we go to Jerry first?
Right. Well, those are two very good questions. Firstly, Joanna, I think what we're talking about is while there is a commitment of the Scottish Government to a just transition, there's also a catch-all version of independence, which is what the SNP promote, which is both corporate-friendly, business-friendly, and not wanting to acknowledge the difficult trade-offs that comes with independence. And so that is something that was going to have to be taken on board and worked on. You cannot have that catch-all, just corporate-friendly view of independence. I have to say, while Roland, I agree with a lot of what you're saying, I think we need a bit of a reality check. Firstly, there's a huge energy in part of the SNP in terms of the party membership. There's then this dysfunction, this break between the party membership and the party leadership. The SNP are not a party in a good state. And while I've heard other things talked about in terms of like very, very good party policies being passed, the SNP are sitting in a place where they are a party in crisis in terms of party governance. You have had a party leadership that has treated you and actually Scotland with an element of contempt and dishonesty. And until there is a kind of healing and an acknowledgement of what's done, possibly with the involvement of Police Scotland, but we don't know where that's going to go. You cannot have a party that is, how do the party membership take back control of their party? And I think this is something I've talked to many SNP members about, who feel absolutely raw about what has happened to their party and feel, bewildered and furious. And these are many people who are pro-Sturgeon, is that it's probably going to take, when that sort of thing happens internally to a party, atrophy, arrogance, treating people with contempt, how do you rectify it? It doesn't happen naturally. It usually happens by an external set of forces, and that is by the voters kicking them and telling them enough is enough. And I think the SNP are going to get quite a bit of a kicking in 2024, and it's highly possible that they then, Humza Yousaf is moves against them, but I don't know the timing of that by Kate Forbes. And if that doesn't work, there will be a move against the SNP in 2026, because people want a politics inside the SNP and in the country that doesn't treat them with contempt, that is about some of the things we've talked about. And the dysfunctionality of the SNP is part of the problem and part of a broken political system that we can do better. And I'm sure we will if voters act in a way that says enough is enough.
I'm going to pass that to Esther, and just the questions are in the chat. So it's about that internal dynamic and just transition.
I'm not in any kind of position to comment on the SNP. I am saddened that we've got a party in government that's having the difficulties it's having, because it's distracting. And the whole notion of somebody trying to be First Minister of the country and party leader at the same time, I certainly wouldn't want his job. But beyond that, I don't think I'm in a position to comment. On the just transition, again, I said earlier on, none of them have been bold enough. The most recent example of that for me is the Land Reform Bill. And that has got quite a lot of positive feedback because there are good things in it, but yet again, not bold enough. And if you look at places like Egg and others where they've gone through community buyouts, not only are they taking the Danish example and are becoming self-sufficient in natural energy rather than fossil fuels, they're generating enough to be giving their communities money back, to be exporting and all the like. So there are good signs of how we could manage it. But of course, it's not helped by the land ownership issue and by the ownership of the energy companies. And that's a major challenge. And, one of the things we've not talked about at all is that as part of the last 20 years, and I'm with Jerry, let's not talk about Thatcher, but in a way, this is a country, Scotland and the UK, that doesn't own anything anymore. And the latest one, which I'm only just beginning to get to grips with, is Freeport's. And one of them's right on my doorstep. And what I'm beginning to read is terrifying me, because that then limits the ability of communities to do the kinds of things we should be able to do in the energy field. But I do think we have to get on. We're past the clock for the just transition. And Scotland could be completely self-sufficient if we addressed transmission and the grid and all the kinds of things that we have the technical capacity to fix. We just need to find the political will. And I've not seen evidence of that from anybody, whether SNP or otherwise.
Thanks both. Harry, bring in more questions?
Yeah, we've got one more if we've got time for it. From Brian. Hi, Brian.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. I find myself made quite emotional by this whole discussion, and it's a surprise to me. And I think it's to do with my identity, even though I hate identity politics, because I think of myself as a Yorkshireman and then a Brit and then a European. And so I think, God, if you guys go, I'll be left. You know, my Britishness is going to disappear. My Europeanness has already been stolen from me. And it makes me feel peely wally, to be quite honest. So I'm all for this community asset building and local action. But the big issue, I think, is we need a countervailing power. And corporate power, come to the question, is corporate power is getting really big. I mean, big companies are bigger than small countries. And they have, and they wield that power. So we need it to be in Europe. That's a gone argument. So the arc of history is that we could just disintegrate into our constituent parts. There's no historical reason why we need to be united, but we need a countervailing power. So the dilemma for progressives is if you put a price on cross-party collaboration in a sort of hung parliament in the UK, if the price for that is we want our independence, isn't that just going to have the effect of making us all weaker? So it's quite a bit of a despairing question, really, because I know there are good people in Ireland, Wales and Scotland, and in fact, Labour never had a majority without a huge number of Scottish Labour MPs. So I just don't understand where we're going to go if we break up. Okay, I think that's the question.
Can I say to you, Brian, just a quick, that's a great set of observations, right? And thank you for that. And thank you for sharing your emotional response. I think that is really valuable. But first, on a quick factual point, right, because we went through this a lot in the run-up to the 97 referendum, and Esther will know this as well. Scotland has always mattered in terms of the Labour numbers, of the size of Labour's majority, but there's only been two parliaments when Scotland was the factor that pushed Labour over the winning line. And that was 1964, a parliament that lasted 18 months because Harold Wilson had a majority of five. And then February 1974, when Labour had four seats more than Ted Heath in a hung parliament, and that parliament lasted from February to October. And then, so in both cases, there were short parliaments that were called by subsequent very quick elections. Scotland does matter, but it's just not the decisive factor. I want to just mention something to you about, you talked about Britishness, and I think I think you've just hit one of the most profound points of the evening that is more salient than all the party politics stuff. If Scotland becomes independent, if Ireland is reunified, there will be a dimension of Britishness. I have all my adult life, or since I ever realised, to be accurate, the Scottish dimension. I've never considered myself politically British, even under Labour governments that I identified with. I always saw it being a problem in the imperial state, the right-wing version of Britain and a right-wing version of Britishness. But I see myself as culturally British. I love aspects of Britishness. I love George Orwell's writing. I love the music of the 60s. I love the Smiths till Morrissey went bonkers. And I loved lots of the post-punk and indie music of the 80s, lots of which has Englishness in it. And I love that you know, Englishness and its relationship to Britishness and so on. And if Scotland becomes independent, there will be a British cultural dimension. And I think Esther sort of mentioned this before. Here's a thought for you. The Britain I would like to live in is a Britain where Scotland was self-governing and Ireland and Wales had reached their own arrangements, but it was a unique British contribution that it also shared between those four nations some element of political cooperation. And actually, there used to be an adaptive British political tradition that you knew how to do that in the world. And its last configuration was probably more even than Scottish and Welsh devolution, probably the Good Friday Agreement. And I think in that's not the world I want to live in, the Scotland I want to live in, not a separate Scotland, not a secessionist Scotland. But the problem in it is really England. And that's not really for me. Like Neil said at the start, that's not for me to impose on you. What does England want to do to be governed? Mm-hmm. Do you want Westminster? You know, and part of England, the Farages and so on, they like this present version of England because it allows them to claim to speak for an England that doesn't speak while, acting as this disruptive force. And So it's kind of up to not you on your own, Brian, but England. And I'd like to hear constructively from a progressive, democratic England, because I'd like to have them as neighbours.
Yeah. We're going to bring Esther in, but just quickly so we can wrap up.
Yeah, it's strange because, like Jerry, you know, I grew up in a Labour tradition, never felt British. I've always felt Scottish and European. But the bottom line for me is we share a set of islands. We are the British Isles. And I think the sense of Britishness has been eroded because we've lost British Telecom, British Coal, British Steel, all the things we had. British Rail, my God, I've got a railway fanatic husband. You know, all of those things have gone. Whatever the constitutional settlement is, like Jerry, I believe Scotland, England and Wales inhabit a set of islands, to be good neighbours and friends. I just don't want to be run by Westminster and treated with disrespect. And if we can find a way to solve that, we don't need disruptive independence.
Great.
But if independence is what we have to have, that's what we'll have. Because I'm a Democrat.
Anything to close, Neil?
No, I think it was a fantastic conversation. I love being part of it. And we need to continue this, obviously. And we need to do more practical things about how do we work together in a new parliament to do all the policy stuff we want, you know, and work together and, you know, learn to respect each other more and, you know, understand each other, you know, because the division over independence, as both Jerry and Esther have said, is kind of, you know, it's important, but it's not the only thing. And really, what's the goal for Scotland and what's the goal for England and where do we share goals, etc. Let's have that conversation and I think we're going to work a lot, you know, a lot more fruitfully together. It's a great conversation. Yeah. Thanks, Lena, and thanks both of you. Brilliant. And thanks for the questions.
Yeah, thanks, folks. To guests, both Jerry and Esther, thanks for joining. And the members, thanks for your questions and your comments and your feelings. And I'll see you again next time on the 9th of April when we'll be talking about trade unions and PR and how that movement came together and what voting systems, how did that matter for the trade union movement, with some brilliant contributions from Lynn Henderson and from Nancy Platts. You can find all the information on our website. And as ever, the support of our members is really what makes any of this possible. So thank you. And yeah, good night.
So, if you like what you've heard today and want to be part of a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast and you'll be able to join us live on future calls just like this one. You can tweet me at Neil, N-E-A-L underscore compass, or compass at compass office. And if you've enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. And it's only fair that they know it's bloody complicated too.